Representative Thompson, Representative Klayman, Representative Hammond, and myself, Representative Drummond. We have a quorum to conduct business. You know the drill about cell phones. Today our recording secretary is Lori Rowland, and Madison Truitt is our LIO moderator assisting with teleconferencing support. Thank you both. My staff, Sarah Evans, is our committee aide. Today we're expected on the House floor at an earlier hour than usual, so we'll do our best to get through our agenda for today within the hour. We plan to hear House Bill 174, Minimum Age to Possess Nicotine e-cig products by Representative Knopp, followed by House Concurrent Resolution 14, Brain Injury Awareness Month by Representative Tuck. My intention is to hear both items on our agenda and not to take public testimony and set both aside until our next meeting. First up, we have Representative Knopp's HB 174. In our packets, we have a draft committee substitute to consider for adoption. Representative Hannon.
I move that the committee, Community and Regional Affairs Committee, adopt the blank. The blank committee substitute.
That's what it's called.
For House Bill 174, Work Order Number 31-LS0957/S as a working document.
I will object for purposes of discussion. Representative Knopp and staff, please introduce yourselves for the record, walk us through the bill and the changes in the CS.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Gary Knopp. I represent District 30. Good morning, and good morning. Madam Co-Chairs Drummond and Hannon and committee members, thanks so much for hearing the bill. I'm going to make a couple of brief opening statements, and I'm going to back away and let my staff run you through the bill. So in regards to the committee substitute, the reason for that is in our initial version of the bill, we put an exemption for military personnel to keep the age limit, I believe, at 18. But since that time, the federal government has taken action which doesn't allow that exemption. They've set the federal standards at 21, so that exemption is no longer applicable. So that was the purpose for the committee substitute, and the only change in the bill is the elimination of that. Secondly, I want to just speak to the need for the bill. I've been asked the question, why do we have to have it if the federal government has already raised the age limit? And the real reason is because of the discrepancy in penalties, what the federal government imposes for penalties for selling tobacco to underage people under 21 is, I guess, in a sense you would say it's a slap on the hands and don't do it again type of punishment. But the state's requirements or penalties for selling to underage is substantially harsher. Without the state bringing this up to the same level as the federal government, we have a discrepancy. So if you were to sell to a person under 21 but age 20, then federal regulations penalties would apply. But if it was sold to somebody under age of 19, then the state regulations would apply. And so that's the discrepancy in the age difference. So if we bring the state's age limit up to 21, then we eliminate that, and then the penalties we have put in over time for selling tobacco products to underage minors would apply. So that was my opening comments, and I'm going to back away from table and let my legislative aides introduce the bill for you. So thank you.
And
we'll be available for any questions.
Okay. I'd also like to note that while we change personnel at the front table, that for questions only, we have available in the room Nancy Mead, court administrator. Online, we have Susan Jaconis, Department of Revenue Tax Division, Christy Knight, Deputy Manager, Tobacco Prevention and Control Program, Joe Darnell, Tobacco Enforcement and Education Lead, and Sharon Walsh, Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, if members of the committee have any questions. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Good morning. My name is Kerry Crocker, staff to Representative Knopp.
For the record, my name is Intamile Harbison, staff to Representative Knopp.
Good morning. HB 174 will change Alaska statutes to match recently implemented federal guidelines of sale of tobacco products. This bill raised the legal age of tobacco in Alaska from 21, in doing so, and discrepancies in both the statute and the enforcement of federal and state tobacco laws. According to the Department of Health and Social Health and Human Services, smoking costs the state of Alaska approximately $575 million annually and kills approximately 700 people annually as well. The deaths of these Alaskans to smoking further costs the state $261 million yearly in lost productivity. According to the Alaska Youth Risk Behavior Survey, 12% of male youth and 9% of female youth use tobacco products. This use of tobacco products becomes more prevalent the higher the grade level the student is, rising from 6% in 9th grade to 16% in 12th grade. The increase in the number of youth tobacco users between their freshman and senior years of high school highlights how access to tobacco products leads to the rise in tobacco use in Alaska. By raising the legal age of tobacco use to the age of 21 from the age of 19, we'll further be removing access to tobacco products from Alaskan youth by removing the access within their own peer groups. It's important to match Alaska smoking statutes with the federal guidelines in order to allow state Alaska enforcement personnel to prevent and enforce sales to underage users. It is the intent of this bill not only to match Alaska statute with the federal guidelines, but to combat tobacco use in Alaska children. It's also important to note that Alaska receives about $2.8 million in federal substance abuse grants, and if we don't comply with the 21, we'll eventually lose some of those grants.
For the record, again, Into my Harbison. I'll be going through specifically the changes between the committee substitute and the original bill. The changes between the committee substitute for House Bill 174 and the original bill before the committee are that it removes Section 3 pertaining to correctional facilities and active duty military members. It amends Section 5 to remove language pertaining to active members of the Armed Forces of the United States. Section 6 is amended to remove Section 3B, which also pertains to active duty military members. Section 6 removes Subsection 4B, which pertains to members of the Armed Forces. Amend Section 12 to remove Subsection 6 pertaining to active duty members of the Armed Forces. And it adds Section 15, which repeals AS 1176-100E. Moving to the sectional analysis, and if you'd like to follow along, Section 1 amends Alaska statute to raise the age of selling or giving tobacco from minor to 21. Section 2 amends Alaska statute to raise the age of selling or giving tobacco from 19 to 21. Section 3 amends Alaska statute to raise the age of possession for tobacco from 19 to 21, as well as removing exemption for prisoners. Section 4 amends Alaska statute to change the age of sale of tobacco outside a controlled area from 19 to 21. Section 5 amends Alaska statute to change the age of selling or giving a product containing nicotine to a minor from minor to 21. Section 6 amends Alaska statute to change the age of selling or giving a product containing nicotine to a minor from 19 to 21. Section 7 amends Alaska statute to change the age of selling or giving a product containing nicotine to a minor from 19 to 21. Section 8 amends Alaska statute to change the age of selling or giving a product containing nicotine to a minor from 19 to 21. Section 9 amends Alaska statute to change the age on the restriction on shipping or transporting cigarettes from 19 to 21. Section 10 amends Alaska statute to change the age on license endorsements for the sale of tobacco products from 19 to 21. Section 11 amends Alaska statute to change the age on license endorsement for the sale of tobacco products from 19 to 21. Section 12 amends Alaska statute to change the age on license endorsement for the sale of tobacco products from 19 to 21. Section 13 amends Alaska statute to change the age on license endorsement for the sale of tobacco products from 19 to 21. Section 14 amends Alaska statute to change the age of possession for tobacco under provisions inapplicable from 19 to 21. Section 15 has no changes and repeals Alaska Statute 1176-100E, and Section 16 provides an effective date of January 1st, 2021.
Okay. With the changes explained by Representative Knopp and staff, I'm going to remove my objection to adopting the CS. Is there further objection to adopting the CS? Seeing none, the CS has been adopted. Are there any questions from the committee for the bill sponsor or anyone online? Yeah. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I'm not quite reading this right. Right now, if somebody sells, an establishment sells cigarettes to somebody under 21 years of age, it says that they can lose their business license. Is that correct?
So if, through the chair, Representative Thompson, sale is made to a minor in the state of Alaska, state agencies are unable to currently enforce federal regulation for sale at 21 years of age because of the current Alaska statute of 19. And so there would not be any state penalty for selling to somebody who is under the age of 21 currently.
Follow-up.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So I think Representative Thompson's question was, can a licensed facility selling tobacco products lose their license for selling to an underage minor? Is that correct, Representative Thompson?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. You know, we tried to take a look at the deep dive into the penalties associated with that, and so much of that is in regulation, not in statute. And when we talked to, which I don't remember if it was occupational licensing or who regulated that, but there's some discretionary stuff in there, but typically, I think first offense, they actually are suspended from selling for 20 days on the first offense, and maybe subsequent offenses, they could, in fact, be revoked, if I remember my readings correctly, sir. So.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
just they lose the right to sell tobacco products, is what you're saying?
I believe the first offense is for 20 days, if I recall.
But it does say that they could suspension of business license. Oh, endorsement, or the right to. Yeah, I was concerned about the losing their business license, or you can follow where I was headed with this.
Yeah, no, the business license, in fact, they just lose the endorsement to sell tobacco products for the 20 days. Yeah.
So at the present time, follow up. At the present time, do businesses have a endorsement on their business license that they can sell?
Yes, if they've applied, yes. Those who,
or will that be something new?
No, it's not new. That's currently in statute. That's the way it works today, through the chair.
Thank you,
Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask this. I believe Christy Knight online, who is the manager of the Prevention and Control. Could you describe for us the specific licensure required to sell tobacco and the process of punishment for violations of that as they are currently, and then our understanding is the simple change would be the age. So if there was something else in that process of licensure to sell and punishment for violating that that would change besides age, please inform us of that.
Christy Knight, are you on the phone with us? And if you are not the correct person to answer that question, anyone else online is welcome to weigh in.
Through the chair, this is Christy Knight with the Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. I believe that question could be best answered by Joe Darnell with Tobacco Enforcement, who is also on the line.
Great, thank you. Mr. Darnell, are you available?
Yes, I am. Through the chair, first, my name is Joe Darnell. I'm with the Department of Behavioral Health, Tobacco Enforcement, and Youth Education. Through the chair to answer that. Right now, and I'll just give a quick overview to sell tobacco product or nicotine product in the state of Alaska. A retailer is required to have a business license and a tobacco endorsement. That's been on the books for quite some time. Once a clerk is convicted of selling to a minor, that conviction then goes over to licensing. And licensing uses the conviction under statute to suspend the endorsement. Like the representative stated earlier, first offense is a 20-day suspension. There is a caveat that they can mitigate that down to a 10-day suspension. They have certain policies and procedures in place prior to the violation. once that first conviction happens, the business is in on a two-year clock, and if they have another violation within that 2 years, it jumps up to a 45-day suspension. A second one after that, it's a 90-day suspension, and a third, they can lose their endorsement, depending on circumstances, from 1 year to indefinitely. So that's kind of what the suspension violations are right now. So all this would do is raise it from 19 up to 21. None of that would change.
Representative Hanna,
follow-up. Mr. Darnell, do you know how many currently endorsed for selling tobacco products businesses there are in Alaska, and how many people do we have doing enforcement?
Right now, through the chair, right now there's approximately, it fluctuates, but between 1,500 and 1,600 tobacco endorsements out right now, and we have a staff of three that actually do active enforcement.
Follow up.
What is the annual frequency of tobacco endorsement penalties on businesses? How many times a year is somebody put on a suspension for selling their tobacco to someone?
Through the chair, right now we've got about a 6% sell rate of tobacco to minors, so that equals out of the businesses that we are sampling. We're looking at anywhere from 10 to 20 suspensions a year, and it takes a while to go through a suspension. I mean, they could have the sale could happen, say, on January 1st, and the suspension might not happen to as far as October once everything goes through the process. So even though you'll have a few sales right away, their suspensions could be 7 to 8 months down the road. So. But we're looking at probably 20 suspensions, 20, 25 suspensions a year.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? I have a question. Mr. Darnell, thank you for weighing in. So I assume that when a tobacco seller's endorsement is suspended, their product stays on their shelf, but they're unable to sell it, and most likely unable to sell it back to their wholesaler or anything like that. So they're just stuck with the product until the suspension is lifted?
Yes, correct.
Okay, that's thank you very much. Any further questions? All right. Hearing no further questions, we will set this bill aside. Thank you, gentlemen, and take it up again at our next meeting. If any member is interested in offering an amendment to this House bill, amendments will be due to my office by noon on Monday, March 9th. Next up, we have HCR 14 by Representative Tuck on Brain Injury Awareness Month. This is our first time hearing this concurrent resolution, so my plan is to hear it and hold it. Representative Tuck, please come forward with your staff, introduce yourselves, and begin your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, co-chairs, for and committee members for allowing us to present HCR 14 this morning. I am Representative Chris Tuck from District 23, South Central Anchorage, and with me is Mike Mason, staff to my office. Thank you for hearing for House Concurrent Resolution 14, proclaiming March 2020 as Brain Injury Awareness Month here in Alaska. The theme for this year's campaign is Change Your Mind. This resolution seeks to draw attention to the effects of brain injuries and the ways to prevent them. Right now, millions of people worldwide are living with brain injuries, and they're categorized as traumatic and acquired. As noted in the resolution, the Brain Injury Association of America reports that every 9 seconds, someone in the U.S. sustains a brain injury. And in the resolution, too, it defines traumatic brain injury, or also known as TBI. And that's on page 1, lines 6 through 8, and that is an injury as a disruption in the normal function of the brain, and that can be caused by bump, blow, or jolt to the head, or penetrating head injury. So basically, it's trauma to the head in some degree or fashion. Data suggests that 12% of the general population has experienced at least one TBI. One out of every 60 people in the U.S. lives with a TBI-related injury. 50,000 people die every year from traumatic brain injuries. And it's estimated that between 3.5 million to 5.3 million Americans live with long-term disabilities resulting from traumatic brain injuries. In 2016, an estimated 27 million new cases of traumatic brain injuries were reported worldwide. And I also want to mention that it can be prevented. I was just reading an article recently where the World War I helmets that were used were just as good, tested just as well as today's helmets in the military. And the one that tested the best was the French military helmet. But, yeah, it tested a little bit better than some of our helmets, modern-day helmets. So, so we've had preventative measures for a long time. I'm really proud to see people wearing helmets when they ride their bikes, when they're skateboarding, when they're rollerblading. As a avid snow machiner and motorcycle enthusiast, I always wear a helmet. I actually did a report in eighth grade about the importance of helmets, and it's stuck with me ever since. Unfortunately, traumatic brain injury is an under-recognized public health problem. The Centers of Disease Control and Prevention notes that everyone is at risk for TBI, especially children and older adults. TBI can be caused by a variety of physical, cognitive, social, emotional, and behavior issues. And outcomes can vary from total recovery to permanently disability or even death. Some signs of TBI immediately after injury include being dazed and confused and not remembering the injury. Some common signs of TBI include persistent headaches or neck pain, sensitivity to light and noise, loss of balance, and changes in sleeping patterns. Acquired brain injury are the kind of brain injuries caused by strokes, oxygen deprivation, seizures, tumors, and substance abuse. And those type of injuries estimates Brain Injury Association of America estimates that over 3.5 million children and adults sustain an acquired brain injury every year. And if you remember a little bit back, Representative Dugan ended up with an acquired brain injury. And I regret this, and I'm going to tell another story here, but now Senator Tom Begich, before he was senator, Dugan was doing a speech, and he recognized that his speech patterns were off. And he said, "Chris, do you mind asking how Mike Dugan is doing? Because his speech pattern looks like it's almost like he had a front lobe injury. And so I felt a little bit bad because I forgot to ask him that day. And then it was just later that week that Mike Dugan was diagnosed with acquired brain injury. So some people were able to detect the signs. In this case, Tom Begich was able to detect the signs. And it just happens. I mean, it's just one of those things that you don't ever plan for, but health-wise, it ends up happening. Recovery from brain injury depends on the degree of damage, amount of support and resources, and level of treatment. It's different for each individual. Receiving the right care at the right time can really have some tremendous gains. And I believe that proclaiming March as Brain Injury Awareness Month, we will increase awareness of TBI and ABI and hopefully prevent future brain injuries. And I look forward to testimony of Annette Afonzi. She's going to be our invited testimony today. And she's the driving force behind House Concurrent Resolution 14. Annette is the Alaska coordinator for the Unmasking Brain Injury Project, which is a global brain injury awareness project created by Heinz Feet Farm in North Carolina. And that's one of the last whereases that we have, the second to last whereas. Oh, sorry, the third to last whereas. Now I want to point out that the second to last whereas on page 2, towards the end, lane 26, Brain Injury Awareness Month is also recognized by the Department of Defense.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Tuck. Does your staff wish to make a presentation, or are we?
No, through the chair, Rep. Tuck hit all the good points.
Okay, great. Are there any questions from the committee for the bill sponsor? Seeing none at this time, Representative Thompson.
Yes, I just wanted to thank you, Madam Chair. I was just concerned that the last whereas, not the last one, but it says that March of 2020 will be Brain Injury Awareness Month. Shouldn't it be every March from here on forward?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Thompson. So this is a resolution. Yeah. It would be a bill if we made it every month.
Okay.
And so Annette Fonzie brought this Brain Injury Awareness Month to my attention. The biggest advocate that we used to have here was Representative Pete Peterson. He was always about the brain injury stuff when he was here. And so I've just kind of picked it up most recently. And in talking with Annette, I thought, well, for this year, let's just try to do a resolution now to bring awareness. I know there are some organizations out there that like to do this annually just to bring attention. There is a concern that if we do pass a bill, make it every month, that you will lose attention, lose that. I can go either way on that. Last year, we did nothing as a legislature. We were so delayed in getting started because of our, you know, the nature of getting organized. And the governor did a proclamation last year. So fortunately, the state did recognize it in one form or fashion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Any further questions from the committee? All right. Seeing none, we will now turn to invited testimony on HCR 14. Annette Alfonsi, are you on the phone with us?
Hello. Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Annette, and I have a disclaimer. Annette is a classmate of my son's. We all know each other in the state of Alaska. Annette, go ahead and put your name and affiliation on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Annette Alfonsi. I'm here on behalf of Unmasking Brain Injury and independently for myself. Thank you very much for letting me speak with you today. Before 2012, I worked for the 1%, had a college degree, was in great health, and was looking at grad school. After I was a passenger in a rollover car accident with a reckless driver, my primary provider gave me one day off of work to rest. I had multiple internal injuries and persistent concussion symptoms over time and was told different things by doctors. Some didn't believe me or assumed my symptoms were only behavioral and not physical. Some said my healing would not improve at all and I would live my life with my current symptoms and would never work again. Some suggested I become a housewife. None of them supported treatments for healing. I was laid off one business day before I would have qualified for medical leave, was denied disability, was told at the municipal and state level that I am not in a category people care to help, and I no longer have a retirement. I am statistically likely to get re-injured, experience homelessness, have lower lifetime outcomes, and have greater risk for comorbid health conditions that most health providers don't currently know they should be screening for. Multidisciplinary treatment, working with a brain injury specialist physician, and leaving Alaska for treatment is what helped me. Leaving was less expensive and more effective than what I paid for and experienced here. When the brain injury doctor I was seeing left Alaska in 2015, I planned a TBI conference while recovering from back surgery so her knowledge could stay in Alaska. Over 100 people attended, and by request, this led to our annual conferences with different host organizations. I've been told I cannot attend educational events because I am a patient, so the events that I plan allow everyone to learn the same thing and facilitates advocacy with knowledge. This year, I'm planning another TBI conference hosted by Hope Community Resources on Friday, March 27th and Saturday, March 28th. We have continuing education credits approved in 8 professional fields, and we're offering distance education, so all of you are invited to attend for free. I plan this with volunteers that want standards of excellence in multidisciplinary and intercultural healthcare around brain injury in Alaska. Go to alaskabraininjuryeducation.com for more info. In 2017, I became the Alaska Coordinator for Unmasking Brain Injury, an internationally known brain injury awareness project in which people with any kind of traumatic or acquired brain injury and their loved ones make a mask with an explanation of their art to share what it feels like to live with a brain injury. We work with groups to host mask-making events and to host mask exhibits. Visit unmaskingbraininjury.org for more info. But I'm still not employable because this type of work with my level of education is only available full-time, and I can't work 40 hours a week. The past 2 years, I've hosted community conversations with groups that tend to have a higher number of clients who have experienced brain injury. This includes organizations in fields like domestic violence, homelessness, reentry, suicide prevention, substance misuse, child abuse, and senior citizens. Directors and project managers know their folks have brain injuries, their clients' brain injuries affect every part of life, and they are often the first point of contact for clients. But they don't understand their clients' symptoms through the lens of brain injury. And I'm quite frankly tired of these groups asking you for more money when they are still ignoring an undercurrent that is the biggest issue for their clients. There are not good social service programs around brain injury compared to mental illness. So if someone has a brain injury and a mental illness and must choose one diagnosis, they may disclose the mental illness to qualify for programs. So I'd like to suggest 2 concrete ideas to this esteemed body. Number one is to make state funding for any group that's known to, or suspected to have more than 50% of their clients experiencing a brain injury be tied to education. In other words, state funds would not be dispersed unless the staff get brain injury education, and the funding should not be used for that education. Unlike medical professionals that tend to focus on diagnosis, these groups focus on function and need to understand the client symptoms they're witnessing. And I know program directors and social service groups that love this idea. The number two idea is to create or support a housing unit specifically for brain injury, the way other housing units are for people with specific diagnoses and health issues. This would allow tailored environmental modifications and could be excellent for group therapies, peer support, and individualized treatment opportunities. And I know directors that love this idea also. Damage to the brain can be healed, but the amount of that healing is dependent on a number of concurrent factors that are not being maximized in Alaska. We need to get away from the idea that someone is good enough or looks fine when inside they're suffering. There's a place for everyone in our community, even with brain injury symptoms. We can do better, and it starts with awareness. Please pass this resolution to raise that awareness. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Annette. I appreciate your testimony. Any questions for Ms. Alfonsi? All right, Annette, if you would please submit your testimony electronically, it would really be appreciated. Then we can make it part of the record without any errors.
Sure, I can do that.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's see, any other questions or comments for the sponsor regarding HCR 14 at this time from the committee? Seeing none. Madam Co-Chair, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Alfonsi and Representative Tuck. I am a survivor of two severe brain injuries, one at 21 in a rollover car accident and one severe assault when I was 32 living abroad where I was hospitalized in a neurological unit in Russia. And it was probably a decade before I had full recovery, but have full function, although maybe some of my colleagues would disagree. The length of recovery time is what is astonishing to most people living with a traumatic brain injury. It is years upon years, and not all survivors are as lucky as I am, but thank you for bringing the awareness and the statistics of Alaska happens to be a place where we have a lot of accidental injuries, and as a result, a lot of traumatic brain injuries are in our population.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is asking for the month of March 2020 to be Brain Injury Awareness Month. It has no physical note, and is there any reasons that we shouldn't maybe go ahead and pass it today?
I don't see any reason why not. Do we have any problems passing it out today?
We can't add amendments next week.
Is anybody interested in an amendment?
No.
If there is no interest in amendment, I'm just going to take the privilege of the chair and ask to move this bill out today. Let's just wing it, Representative Hannon.
Good with me.
Yeah, I need a motion.
I move that the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee move House Concurrent Resolution 14, our committee substitute that we adopted, which is...
No, that was the first bill.
Oh, it was the first bill.
This bill is unadulterated.
Sorry. So House Concurrent Resolution 14, number 31-LS1582/A from committee with individual recommendations.
And a zero fiscal note. All right. Thank you. Any objection to moving this bill out? Okay, seeing none, the bill is moving out of committee. We will do the paperwork after we adjourned. Congratulations, Representative Tuck. Let's move it out quickly so that March can be Traumatic Brain Injury Awareness Month. Our next House Community and Regional Affairs meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, March 10th at 8 a.m. in this room. We will be hearing House Bill 174, Minimum Age to Possess Nicotine E-Cig Products by Representative Knopp, and we will not be hearing HCR 14 for the second time. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? Hearing none, we are adjourned at 8:37 a.m. Good work, folks.